like to open the Senate Education and General Government Committee. We are going to be moving on to Senate Bill 478 as soon as we take care of some business committee. I'd like to open up a work session on Senate Bill 442. We adopted the amendments last week. This is a vote to send it to the floor. And if you notice, we do have a fiscal statement on that. I understand, however, the amount in that fiscal statement will be covered by COPs, according to the university system. And so that's the reason you have that fiscal statement. And we will send it to the floor if the Senate President decides otherwise in the next few days. He has the discretion to refer it to Ways and Means. Okay. Senator Morse?
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 442 as amended to the floor with a DUPAS recommendation.
Senator Morse moves Senate Bill 442 as amended to the floor with a DUPAS recommendation. Discussion? Seeing none, the clerk will call the roll.
Senator Bonaducci?
Aye.
Senator Cruz?
Aye.
Aye.
Chair Morse?
Aye.
Chair Hatch?
Aye. Measure passes, and I will carry it. And now I would like to open up a public hearing on Senate Bill 478. Ms. Richardson.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 478 adjusts the Oregon Opportunity Grant calculation of the cost of education for certain private institutions of higher education to take into account some of the amount that the cost of education is reduced at public institutions of higher education as a result of public funds. It declares an emergency and take effect July 1st, 2009.
Okay, and Senator Monroe is here. I'd like to come forward with Mr. Andine. Welcome to both of you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Rod Monroe, State Senator, District 24 in East Portland and Northern Clackamas County. Mr. Chair, if it'd be your pleasure, I have a few comments, and then I'd like to turn things over to Gary Andine, who will speak briefly and then introduce three college presidents who are with us this morning. The Oregon Opportunity Grant is a critical part or plays a critical role in the education of students in Oregon. A lot of people think, why should the state government care about private independent colleges? After all, they are private and they are independent. So why should we be concerned about their funding? If we did not have the private independent colleges in this state to provide a choice and an opportunity for many of our students to get a good education, a quality education, we would have to build two more University of Oregons, because there are 38,000 students in Oregon, Oregon students that are educated in private independent colleges. I've been an educator all my life. I've taught in public institutions like PCC and like Tigard High School, and I've taught in private colleges like Warner Pacific and George Fox. And I've seen some of the advantages and disadvantages that they have. One thing I've noticed is that the private independent colleges generally have smaller class size, especially for lower classmen, for freshmen and sophomores. This is a huge difference. If young people attend Oregon State or Portland State or U of O as freshmen, they often end up in huge survey classes of maybe 400 or 500 students, usually not taught by a full professor, usually taught by some intern, some student professor, if you want to call them that. And oftentimes they get lost, whereas 18-year-olds, 19-year-olds that have an opportunity to go to a small independent college do end up paying more, but they find themselves in smaller classes with professors that know their name and who really care and do everything they can to make sure they're successful. As you know, I also serve on a community college board, and community colleges also play a key role. But we don't want to lose the quality of our independent colleges. We need to be supporting them. We need to be assisting them. We'll never subsidize them to the degree that we do our universities and community colleges, nor should we. But some degree through these grants some degree of assistance, perhaps a little greater degree of assistance than what we're now providing, seems to make sense to me. As you know, I chair the Education Subcommittee of Ways and Means, where this bill will next head after you discuss it. Your recommendations are going to be very important to me, so I would hope this committee will take its work with a great deal of thought and will make your recommendations to Ways and Means so that we can use those recommendations to make the best choices for all of the young people of the state of Oregon. With that, please excuse me. I am tardy to a Ways and Means subcommittee meeting. Thank you very much. I'd be happy to answer questions before I leave.
Senator Cruz.
Yeah, thank you. Mr. Chair, Senator Monroe, I graduated from Willamette, and so don't hold that against small colleges. There is an advantage. Clearly, my economic statistics class, there were 3 students, which was good, except there was no place to hide. I guess my question, Senator, is money at this point in time. Under normal circumstances, I fully support this. I think this is appropriate, but we have a long list of students that want to get in this program, and I'm not sure where the money's going to come from even to maintain current levels. So I guess, and I'm not asking for an answer at this point in time, but clearly I think for those kids that are already basing their education on being a participant, it's important that they continue. So just be mindful of, I don't know that we have enough money to do all we would like to do with this program. So,
well, thank you, Senator Cruz. We don't have enough money. And believe me, I know that.
I know you know that.
And it troubles me sometimes. I wake up in the middle of the night. But I do believe that balance is going to be critical. And I hope that my Ways and Means Subcommittee, the full Ways and Means Committee, with the advice from your committee, will be able to achieve an appropriate level of balance. Everything's getting cut this year. We all know that. But maintaining core services, and education being the most critical, perhaps, core service, is important. And I think maintaining the balance, the actions we take should not tip dramatically either toward our universities, our community colleges, or our private independent colleges, but they should express a level of balance and fairness, and that's all I'm asking for.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Any other questions? Mr. Andine?
Thanks. We'll get him, Gary.
Good afternoon, Senator Hess. For the record, I'm Gary Ann Dean. I'm the president of the Oregon Independent Colleges Association, and I'm thankful particularly to you and to all the legislators who have followed you for the last 40 years in keeping a state student aid program open to needy Oregonians attending the private colleges in the state. This is something that virtually every other state in the country does the same thing, with the exception of Wyoming, where there are no private colleges, and with the exception of Nevada, and I don't know the reason for there. But this is a common program. We're not asking you to start anything new that didn't exist before. We're asking you in this bill to rebalance a balance that was lost with the new formula that we put into play during the last session. Just to reset that balance to where it was before we started the shared responsibility model. We think that there is money inside the governor's budget, even inside the ELB budget, to do this without taking any money from students going to community colleges or state universities, and I'll be happy to discuss those numbers with you later. You have my testimony. I'm not going to read it. I just summarize a little bit, if you don't mind. The first part has to do with context, and it reviews a little bit about the importance and the value of private colleges to the state of Oregon, for economic reasons as well as cultural reasons. I don't need to go through all those numbers, but you have them in front of you there. A couple of numbers that always come as a shock to people when I first bring them up are that the income profiles of students attending private colleges in Oregon is is identical to the income profile of students attending our state universities. We have just as large a percentage of low-income students as state universities, and about the same percentage of high-income students, in fact, a little lower percentage of high-income students. That's always sort of an eye-opener for people. Another eye-opener, I like to point out that about 15,000 students at the independent colleges in Oregon came here from other states. They each dropped $30,000 to $35,000 a year in college expenses. If you multiply 15,000 times 35,000, you come up with a very, very large number, over $500 million of brand new money coming into the state's economy without any multipliers being added to that. This is, if not for cultural reasons, I would cite economic reasons to want to maintain a good private college community in the state. The second page, I describe the history a little bit because it's important to understand that we are not asking for anything new. We're just asking for what we had a year ago, which was a recognition inside the state student aid formula that the costs to students are higher at private colleges. We're certainly not asking that you recognize the full cost. Private colleges do spend more money on some things than public institutions are allowed to, unfortunately. But the costs are at least higher in relation to the state subsidy that holds tuitions down in the public sector. And we're asking that you recognize the state university costs plus some portion of that subsidy that makes up a good part of the differential between the two sectors. We're not asking for the whole subsidy. The whole subsidy is $4,600 according to the state system, and you'll see that number on the very last page of my packet. We're suggesting that it would be nice if we could at least have half that subsidy recognized in the cost figures that go into making up the need grant formula for the eligible students going to independent colleges in the state. We have appreciated very much. The last point I would make about the history of all this is that when the governor approached us in 2005, in fact, it was closing days of the session of 2005 when the governor came before one of the education committees, I forget if it was the House or the Senate, and said, I want to launch a major new program in student aid in the state. What he had in mind was the Georgia Hope scholarships, and he was going to fund it with an endowment fund. And once he and his staff figured out that this would take a couple billion dollars of an endowment fund, we backed off and rethought that. And we've been working with the governor, as have the state system and the community college folks, for the last 3 or 4 years to come up with a new program. And as you all know, last session, that new program was the shared responsibility model, about which we were all very, very excited because it was the mechanism for doubling the state's commitment to student aid. And if we double it again, and then I double it yet one more time, we will be up to what the average state spends on student aid. That's how far in the hole our program has been for many, 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 many years. So we've been very happy to work with the governor on that. The only request that we had was, as we go into the new program, please do not try to ask for a cost differential recognition in the new program. There will be plenty of new money and plenty of new students served in the new program to offset any loss in funds. Turned out that those early projections in 2006 did not turn out to be the way it worked for our students and for our institutions. While the money for the community colleges went up 144%, the money for students going to independent colleges went up 24%. While the money for state university students went up 151%, ours was up 24%. Our average grants went down 25% because of this. This was a very difficult thing for our students to absorb and for our institutions to absorb. We don't want to have to do that more than this 1 year. So this is why we're bringing this legislation before you. The other charts in there just walk through some of the things I've already talked about and provide you with a lot of numbers that you might find of interest as we discuss this further. There is one graphic about 3 or 4 pages in that points out that we have had undergraduate enrollment at private colleges in Oregon essentially arrested for the last 20 years. Private colleges have been growing throughout those 20 years, but they've been growing in out-of-state students and in graduate students. There is capacity in the private sector for another 4,000 or 5,000 students easily to be absorbed right now if we had some student aid help to attract them to these institutions. That could take a lot of pressure off of the state system and off of the state having to fund all those extra students in the public sector or even not enroll them because you don't have room. And then finally, the last four or five pages are some of the student profiles that I know we have been sharing with you week by week during the session, more electronically this session than in the past. I managed to find a student profile from the alma mater of Senator Metzger, from the alma mater of Senator Morris, from the alma mater of Senator Cruz, from the alma mater of Senator Monroe, even though he's left. I couldn't find anything from Bard or Wesley, but I looked. And I couldn't find anything from American University, but if we could extend the opportunity grants across state lines, I'm sure I could do that, too.
Appreciate your research on that. I was an undergraduate at Duckville.
So at where?
University of Oregon.
Oh, thank you.
As was I.
Okay.
That's it. I'd be happy to take any questions, Senator Hass. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions, committee? Well, thank you, Mr. Andine. Appreciate it. We'll have you on standby as we go forward.
Okay.
We have a long list of people who want to testify on this. We have some very distinguished college presidents here and some very distinguished-looking students here, and I think that's outstanding. And we are under a time constraint, and so I wanted to say, when you do come forward, there is no need to read, if you have something prepared in writing, to read directly from that. It would be most helpful if you didn't just repeat what has been said before. And we are going to try to keep everyone to around 3 minutes. We won't blow a horn if you're not there, but that's how we're able to do this. And I think this will be a good hearing if we can keep it at that. I don't want to see any more signs go up in the back. This is not a football game. So let's start with our presidents, Tom Hilly, Andrea Cook, and Tom Hochstetler.
We figured out who's going first.
Okay, I'll start. Good afternoon. For the record, I'm Andrea Cook, president-elect of Warner Pacific College. And I want to thank you for this opportunity, Chair Hass, and the committee for the opportunity to speak in support of the Senate Bill 478. In order not to repeat everything that's been said, let me just highlight a couple of points. As Gary and Dean mentioned, our students do not have higher incomes than those attending public universities. In fact, at Warner Pacific College, our students have the highest percentage of students who are, we have the highest percentage of students that are Pell eligible in most of the state institutions in Oregon, in any of the public, private, and community colleges. We also serve a population of first-generation college students. And because of that, we have created academic and administrative structures that provide a safety net of support for them. And it allows them to be successful, where in many cases going to a different college setting would create a situation where many of them would be victims of attrition. We believe that all students should have access to programs and opportunities that best fit their needs, and some of those are uniquely offered at Oregon Independent Colleges. Additional resources through the Oregon Opportunity Grant is critical to provide the possibility for all Oregon residents to benefit from the range of educational opportunities. As Gary mentioned, we do have capacity. We are growing, but we have room to grow, and so we'd be glad to serve those students. Realistically, too, this is a benefit for Oregon taxpayers. For the 2007-2009 biennium, taxpayer support per full-time equivalent student ranged from $220 for those attending independent colleges to more than $6,500 when you include all of the taxpayer support that goes to students attending public universities. Providing the Oregon Opportunity Grant to aid students attending independent colleges is a cost-effective way to use taxpayer resources to provide educational opportunity for Oregon residents. It keeps the cost-effective nature there by not having to grow programs and not having to build buildings at public universities where independent colleges could serve those students. By enacting this bill, the Oregon Opportunity Grant for students attending independent colleges and universities will help fill the gap between the millions millions of dollars that our institutions already provide in student aid, and will make it possible for students to attend our institutions rather than having to make decisions to attend what is our lower cost institutions. Thank you. I'd be glad to answer any questions.
Why don't we take the whole panel first, okay, and then we'll ask questions.
Well, why don't I go second? For the record, I'm Tom Hostetler. I'm the president of Lewis and Clark College. I want to pick up on a few points that Andrea has just made, and particularly with regard to the cost-effectiveness of increasing the opportunity grants for students who are attending our colleges. As you well know, the private colleges of Oregon expend huge sums of money. 2 years ago, that sum was $173 million in grants and scholarships for students. And large though that number may seem to be, it is not adequate to meet all of the needs of our students. At Lewis and Clark, which is one of the colleges in the states which has a relatively high endowment, we're only able to meet about 80% of the need of our students. To that extent, increasing the Oregon Opportunity Grants for our in-state students can be enormously successful as a leverage for those students to make certain that they will come to Lewis and Clark or even to stay within the state. One of the things that we have discovered is that students who do not have the funds, and either from us or from the state or from other resources, through jobs, through loans, tend not to stay in state. You've heard that other states offer larger support for students out of state, not that Oregonians qualify for that support, but it suggests that other states take more seriously than we have been able historically to do the obligation to educate young people. At Lewis and Clark, those students, 3 out of 10, whom we cannot support from Oregon, even with the Oregon Opportunity Grants, 3 out of 10 of those students they go out of state. 76% of the students who don't come to us go to independent colleges outside of the state. And I would like to suggest that there is a huge opportunity cost when Oregonians have to leave Oregon to get an education. They do not go to the public universities. They tend not to go to the community colleges. The kind of student who would come to a private independent college in Oregon, those students want to go to an independent college, and they will leave the state in order to do that. What we're asking for, in essence, is another $1,000 per year on average for these students. What you get for that $1,000 per year is an education that at Lewis and Clark would cost you $120,000 over the course of the 4 years. I think that's a huge bargain. It's a tremendous leverage that you have the opportunity to provide, particularly for those marginal students who otherwise won't stay in state but will leave. Thank you for your attention. If you have any questions, I'd be glad to answer them as well. Okay.
Chairman Hess and committee, I want to thank you, first of all, for hearing us out today, and I want to thank you for your commitment to education in Oregon. There's perhaps nothing that's more important to our state's future. I'll try to summarize my written remarks as well.
Why don't you start off with your name? So we
I'm
have
sorry.
It.
I'm Thomas Helley, president of Linfield College. I want to say a word about another word about private colleges. There were a couple of facts that I didn't even realize until Gary Andeen pointed them out to me. First of all, that 90% of the elementary school teachers in the state of Oregon are educated at private colleges, 90%. And that two-thirds of the students who graduate with bachelors of science and nursing degrees go to private colleges. And what's more, most of the rest of the BSNs go to OHSU, which would also benefit from for Bill 478. I think those are important facts to recognize because education and healthcare are two of the most critical needs that our state is facing. This issue is a matter of concern for us at Linfield and at all private colleges because a year ago, our students who qualified for the Oregon Opportunity Grant would have been receiving about $3,029, at least on average. This year they received $2,260. It's a significant decrease for the neediest students who are enrolling at our colleges. And these are the students who I think we most need to educate and most need to make this opportunity available to. And so For that reason, I think that even as you are striving to find the money to do this and to strike the right balance, we need to recognize the obligation that we have to some of our neediest folks. One Linfield student had really wanted to come today, but she can't. It's spring break, as you know. Kelly Willits is not in Cancun. Instead, she is volunteering as a camp counselor for foster children with the Rainbow Family Services. But she sent me an email, and I want to read just a little bit of what she said. She said, "I thrive in the small college environment because of the small class sizes and face-to-face communication with professors. I don't feel that students who may not have the resources should only be confined to public universities. Colleges should be selected based on fit between the student and the institution." She went on to explain that her family has very limited resources and that the Oregon Opportunity Grant is part of what made it possible for her to attend Linfield, and we're very proud that she's there. Like everyone else, the economic downturn has affected us at the college. This year we've announced that we will not be giving any salary increases for the coming year. We are going to be increasing our budget, but our budget increases are almost all going into financial aid for students because we recognize that the need is great and we are committed to doing our best to meet the need, but we need your help. Again, I thank you for the important work you're doing. I know that you have very tough decisions to make, and I appreciate all of the support that you've already given us. Thank you.
Well, thank all three of you. I do have one question. I think, Mr. Hostetler, you mentioned that there's the powerful leverage component here. Could you go into that? I think you said you put a number to it, but in what ways? Leveraging money, because that's an important dynamic here at the legislature.
Absolutely, and I certainly appreciate that. I'm talking about these marginal students, those students who, if they don't have that somewhat higher level of support, the support that we as institutions cannot give them, that these students, if they get that extra $1,000 a year or that extra $4,000 that they will get over the course of the next 4 years, assuming that the next biennium also approves this increase, students at least at Lewis and Clark College that would be able to attend Lewis and Clark College would be getting that full education, quite apart from having to create a new position, a new student position at one of the state colleges or universities or at a community college. The leverage is it seems to me to be a very powerful one that puts those students into the classrooms at the private colleges, whereas the state then can avoid having to build those extra student slots at other institutions. You heard, I believe, I can't remember what the number was that Gary and Dean mentioned about the extra capacity that our colleges have. Lewis and Clark happens not to be one of those institutions. We're chock-a-block with students, but there are spaces at other institutions where if the student had that extra money and if the colleges came up with the other resources to make sure that that student could attend the college and succeed at that college, that those students would be able to attend. I'd also like to say that any time a student does not attend, any time a student goes out of state or a student drops out, that there's a huge opportunity cost there. Even to have one student who doesn't go to college and get that baccalaureate degree or even an associate degree represents a failure on the part of us as a society, and I would suggest as a polity to do the best that it can to make certain that citizens get every service that they need. So to that extent, as I say, we're willing to put our resources on the line, and we're asking the state to step up and give us a little bit more help as we do best what we know how to do.
Thank you. Other questions? Senator Metzger.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a comment, Mr. Chair, and thank all three of you. And you've been with us all day and joining us in the Senate this morning for coming today. And I think it is important. I think Mr. Andine pointed this out. As the legislature has worked to recognize the the role that we need to play in helping people go to college. That's why we have the shared responsibility model and trying to up those dollars. This is the goal of everyone, is to get more people involved in higher education, Oregonians involved in. And certainly it was not the intent of the legislation to change what, you know, the formulas somehow turn out different than what you anticipate. And so, and I support this legislation. I think it's, everyone came to the table and supported the share responsibility model, but the way it came out, it turned out to be an impact. And I would just reiterate what President Hostetler said, and appreciate your service, and, you know, I'm glad we're not investing in Idaho anymore or any other things and some of those empty fields.
Thank you, Senator. Senator Metzger is one of our double alums.
And but I will point out is that you know, having that choice for students for Oregon is really important. And sometimes, you know, people think of, you know, the elite schools and stuff, but the reality is, and I know Senator Cruz, we graduated at the same time, and I was lucky enough to get admitted to Lewis and Clark, so he went to Willamette. But you know, the reality is, it's for Oregonians, it is because of the great work of the endowments and things. It's people can't afford to go to college, and I couldn't afford to go to Oregon State. I had four sisters, you know, a dad who was a postmaster, and it was only because of the great financial aid that Lewis and Clark could have, you know, and gave me a job as a custodian to help do the rest of it. There was no opportunity grant at all, but was able to go through and get an education like that, and, you know, have Dr. Saban and Dr. Ward with 14 other students, like you say, you couldn't hide. But, you know, that was a model that fit well. And it's unfortunate that just as we do these formulations, you know, some of those opportunities, you know, have shifted a little bit. So I appreciate what all of you do, and I think this is an idea to, it's not public versus private or community college versus higher ed. These are all people who are serving our students and trying to have a better educated workforce and trying to find that balance so that choice doesn't become, well, a few hundred dollars means I have to go somewhere else. We want all these students to have at least an opportunity to come to Oregon where they want to become a Duck, you know, a Bearcat, a Pioneer, you know, a Wildcat or whatever it is. I don't know what Warner Pacific is. What is it?
The Knights,
or become a Knight, you know, to have those opportunities. So that's just my comment, but I really appreciate you folks coming down today and sharing that with us.
As we all do. Thank you, three. And now call up Mike Johnson, Cindy Pollard.
Thank you for this opportunity, Senator Haas, and the rest of the committee. My name is Cindy Pollard, and I am Director of Student Financial Services Financial Aid at Warner Pacific College. And I will just briefly summarize my remarks that I've written for you. Piggyback a little bit on what Senator Metzger had said, my testimony is all about giving students choice. I see that many of our students that come in are high need. 27% of our overall student population receives the Oregon Opportunity Grant. So we serve an urban community, urban students, who really won't have a choice if we don't find a way to help meet them, at least part way. So in light of that, in spirit of that, we reduced our tuition for 08-09. In essence, we gave everybody a scholarship. We reduced it by $6,000. That was a pretty big and bold step that our institution took. And we did it because we wanted to help make those federal and state dollars go further in helping the student finance their education. We believe that that would be a way that we could help students who didn't have a choice about attending a private education, a private college, get that choice. Students need, and often we find our students, because they're high need, they don't have the financial support and they don't have the family structure. And so customer service is critical for them. So we offer customer service, we offer financial aid, and we try and help those students that wouldn't succeed be successful. But we need your partnership as well. Thank you.
Appreciate that. That's quite a gift. What, if I may ask, what is the tuition?
$16,000
And you lowered it by 6,000?
It was, yes. 16,000 is the lowered tuition.
So it was 22?
Yes.
Good. I think Senator Metzger and I would be washing dishes somewhere if that's what we could. Mr. Johnson?
All right, well, thank you. For the record, I'm Mike Johnson. I'm the Director of Financial Aid at Pacific University in Forest Grove, and I, too, would like to thank you for hearing us today and for your continued support of higher education in Oregon. What I'd like to do is briefly tell you something about the Opportunity Grant recipients at Pacific and then suggest some reasons why I think Senate Bill 478 is a really good idea. I may say a few things that our presidents already did. I think if I do that, that'll be okay because I liked what they said, but I will try to be brave. About 50% of our nearly 1,500 undergraduate students are Oregon residents, and of the number of Oregon residents, 28% are Oregon Opportunity Grant recipients. So we have significant numbers, not overwhelming numbers, but we serve a lot of Oregonians, and a lot of them are needy. Which leads to my second point. Our Opportunity Grant recipients are among our neediest students. Their average expected family contribution, the number that appears on the free application for federal student aid, is a little over 1,500. It's 1,586. What that means is that the federal methodology suggests that they can afford only about $1,500 to attend college or university. Very low. That 1,586 number represents or reflects an average 2007 family income of a little over $27,000. So we are serving very needy students with the Oregon Opportunity Grant currently. Without significant financial assistance, post-secondary educational choices are very limited for these students. The passage of this bill would provide them with increased access to, and I think importantly, increased choice in, as you've heard already, higher education. This investment in their futures would produce both individual and societal benefits. First, it would allow low-income students to think of private higher education as financially feasible rather than out of reach. This, in turn, would allow more of those students to participate in the close mentoring educational environment that private institutions provide and that the presidents have already discussed. It would make it possible for more of those students to choose a private college or university in Oregon rather than in another state, which is important to all of us. Those students who remain in Oregon after graduation would be well-equipped to make economic, social, and civic contributions to the state. And lastly, those students who move to other states after graduation would be ambassadors for and testaments to the kind of private education available at Oregon colleges and universities, potentially drawing future students and residents to Oregon. So it would be a win-win, I think, for providing this additional resource to the students who come to our institutions. Thank you again for the opportunity to speak in support of this legislation, and thank you again for your continued support. Like everyone else, we would be happy to answer any questions you might have.
Mr. Johnson, what's the tuition at Pacific?
Our tuition for the coming year is going to be a little over $29,000.
Questions? One that we've had difficulty with here and on other issues is the extremely stubbornly low participation rate in rural Oregon. I know most of you are in the metro area. I know Pacific, Linfield, out a ways. But what have you done to encourage more admissions from rural parts of the state?
Well, for us, Senator Haas, we have beefed up our admissions staff, and we make more trips across Oregon. We have more people working in the state to hopefully show those students that we're here and available to meet their higher education needs.
Okay. We will take and discuss enrollment with any student that we can get their ear. So we travel and connect, and I go wherever I'm sent.
It's okay if you don't have a magic plan, because none of us do. So.
Yeah.
Well, thank you both for coming down and testifying on this.
Thank you.
I appreciate your help. Okay, Kaylee Stevens from, is she here? Would you like to come up, and you can be joined by Kyle Caddy.
Yeah.
Sean Tolan. Yeah, go ahead. Ms. Stevens, if you'd like to begin.
All right. For the record, I'm Kaylee Stevens from Amity, Oregon, so a rural town.
I am a student at Linfield College, and as a student and recipient of the Oregon Opportunity Grant, I just thought it would be important to speak on my behalf and other students from Linfield that are here who may have the same experiences as myself. So I thought I'd just give a little background and also say thank you for the opportunity to speak. So I am a student of Linfield. I come from a low-income family, and I actually pay for college myself, so we really appreciate every bit of financial aid that we can get. And as everyone and the budgets are probably the big marker, I am affected by the economic downturn. My dad actually lost his job, so just every bit of money helps. And I just, as a student, I just thought I'd like to give my piece and say thank you for your work that you've been doing. Thank you.
We appreciate that very much. Now, you live near, relatively near Linfield, right? You grew up in that area. Was that the factor in why you chose that, or maybe you could tell us
yeah.
why you chose Linfield?
Yeah, actually, that's a good question. I also wanted to mention I was in the Upward Bound program. So they, and I kind of already knew that I wanted to go to Linfield. So, like, with the help of them, they gave me a lot of encouragement. And with the staff at Linfield and the financial aid staff, I was able to have the opportunity to go.
It wasn't because they always have an outstanding football team.
No. Those championships didn't hook me, but yeah.
I think, Mr. Chair, I think she's wearing Linfield purple.
I am,
it looks
yeah.
like to me. So. Okay, we're just going in order here. So is it Kyle?
Mm-hmm. Kyle? Thank you. Chair Haas, members of the committee, I'm Kyle Cade. I'm a Portland State student. I'm also the current student body vice president. Before attending Portland State University, I was a Portland Community College student for 3 years. And from 2005 to 2006, I was the student president of the Oregon Community College Student Association. So I'm here representing the Oregon Student Association, which most of you know represents over 100,000 students across the state. And I am here in opposition of Senate Bill 478. And I want to do this with due respect to all the independent colleges. So the Oregon Opportunity Grant and other financial aid programs are essential demand-side subsidies for schools. Because there's a finite amount of Oregon Opportunity Grant dollars, any decrease in the apportionment of grant money away from public universities will be, in effect, a cut to the community colleges and the Oregon public universities. At a time when both of our state-funded post-secondary education systems are facing an existential budget crisis, draining any additional funds away from their campuses would decrease the state's capacity to educate Oregonians quickly and affordably, in accordance with the mission of Oregon's public colleges. Because of budget constraints, new recipients of the Oregon Opportunity Grant were placed on a wait list starting December 1st of last year. As of Monday of this week, nearly 6,800 students have applied, been approved as eligible, and were put on a wait list. 98% of which were either a community college student or applied to a community college or Oregon University. And more than 80% are non-dependent students, most of whom are presumably looking for quick, affordable ways to increase their employability as Oregon's economy contracts. A time that we can't afford to give opportunity grants to nearly 6,700 students who want to attend public colleges, why should we expand this program to decrease the availability of already scarce funds? It's a question of priorities. We can maximize the impact of the Oregon Opportunity Grant by allowing as many students as possible to achieve an affordable public education, or we can send fewer Oregonians to college by using it to pay for a drastically more expensive tuition at private universities. And Portland State's tuition is about $5,500. This is not the time to be expanding this kind of coverage, and we should be making sure that public colleges are affordable before we do private ones. This will be increasingly difficult as tuition at community colleges and Oregon University systems institutions will likely be skyrocketing over the next 2 years, if not longer. Tuition increases in double digits would drastically reduce the impact of the Pell Grant increases and will already be diminishing the ability of the Oregon Opportunity Grant to make a college affordable. When tuition goes up, the Oregon Opportunity Grant significantly decreases in accordance. This bill would exacerbate the dynamic by decreasing grant money that is available while tuition increases will likely be the fastest in decade, if not in the entire history, for the Oregon public colleges. Now is the worst possible time for this bill to pass. Also, as things change, the opportunity and merits of this bill will be that we do believe that this bill is good, but in the financial situation, it's not a feasible solution, and that the Assistant Commission was already created and has members of all the educational communities across the state, has private institutions, stakeholders, has community college students and university students on there, as well as representatives from their community, and that they should be able to make that decision. It doesn't necessarily have to be a legislative process, because that's why the commission was created. So, Chair Haas, member of the committee, we need to make the wisest investment with our precious dollars. The bill does the opposite. Please do what is best for Oregon students and for the best for the state of Oregon by not passing Senate Bill 478.
Thank you. Questions? Appreciate your testimony on this. Convey our congratulations to your school's basketball success this year. Sean Tolan.
Thank you, Chairman Haas. For the record, my name is Sean Tolan. I am a business student at Concordia University and the Northern Regional Vice President of Phi Theta Kappa Honor Society. 4 years ago, I was homeless, and I was living in the Portland Rescue Mission. I had been battling 18 years of addiction, and I finally got help, and I got treatment. And through the encouragement of my mentor, my sponsor, I was able to pursue a lifelong dream that I'd always fallen short of. Nobody in my family's ever went to college. And I couldn't do this alone. And so I was able to get in through a financial aid package and an encouragement of my mentors into a community college system. And after my first term, I made the honor roll, and I was able to begin thinking about even further pursuing baccalaureate studies. And I went out on spring break before I actually graduated, and I turned it into a research assignment as to where I was going to go. I toured public institutions. I toured private institutions. Concordia University was not at the top of my list, but as I began to look at class sizes and opportunity for someone like myself, the individual attention, Concordia University ended up being a right fit for my learning style, the professors, everything. The Oregon Opportunity Grant, along the way, has provided someone like myself with the opportunity to pursue my dreams and give back to a community that I had been taking from for so long. I feel both a duty and an obligation to be an active, productive member of that community. And the funds from the Oregon Opportunity Grant, I don't believe it should be an either-or, a public versus private. Just a leveling of the playing field and giving people like myself and people that I work with the opportunity to have a choice in where they go. And those funds have made a huge difference. And unfortunately, due to some decreases in funding and sheer scarcity, I'm looking at maybe having to leave Concordia in the fall. And that's tough. But mine is just an individual story, but I know many others just like mine. I continue to work with people and helping them get off the streets and get out of our courts and out of our prison systems and begin giving back and coming out and working on community green projects. What the Oregon Opportunity Grant and financial aid provides to people like this is exponential and extremely, in my opinion, fiscally more responsible than punishment and incarceration. And giving these people an education, we're empowering them in our communities. And so I don't represent a large base, but I do believe a valuable base. And Chairman Haas and all the members of this committee, I thank you for giving me the opportunity to just share a little bit of my story. And thank you for allowing me to support SB 478.
Well, we pretty much thank you for your heartfelt testimony and sympathize with your situation. Questions? Senator Bonamici.
Thank you, Chair Haas. I just want to thank all of you for coming to tell your stories, but I especially want to acknowledge Kyle for coming up in what appears to be a room full of proponents for a bill, giving us some the other side of the story and some other things to think about to remind us that it's not always easy making these decisions. But thank you all for telling your stories. Appreciate it.
Thank you. Okay, moving down the list. Forgive me in advance for my pronunciation mistakes. Madeline Reiner. Madeline. I want to say Randy Bobernay. Marco Bialto.
Are you ready?
We're ready.
For the record, my name is Madeline Reiner, and I'm the Vice President for Admission and Financial Aid at Willamette University. And I want to say that it's a privilege to be here today, and thank you so much for the chance to speak in favor of Senate Bill 478. I appreciate the chance to comment, and I also want to tell you, give you my special thanks for the good work that you have done already, and I know will continue to do to support Oregon students. I'd like to talk just a little bit about Willamette and our experience with the Oregon Opportunity Grant. Willamette, like other schools who have spoken to you here today, we also have had a mission and historically have educated a high percentage of first-generation Oregon students. Many of those students are Pell eligible. They would be among the most needy residents in the state of Oregon. And although that's somewhat unlikely for a school in our category, a highly competitive liberal arts institution, it has been part of Willamette's mission, and it's important to us. So I want to tell you a little bit about Oregon residents at Willamette. 30% of our students come from the state of Oregon, and I want to tell you that they themselves work really hard to help afford their education, because there's this sense that you might have that we're asking for more so our students can do less. And I would just like to suggest that Willamette students, and I'm sure students at other schools, are working very hard. The average Willamette student, Oregon resident, last summer earned more than $4,200 to help pay for his or her college education in this current academic year. They also borrow to pay for college. Our average graduate graduates with $24,000 in debt, so that means that they're borrowing to invest in their own educational future in the same way that the Oregon Educational Grant invests in their future. Our students repay their loans. They have less than a 1% default rate. We're very proud of that. We're very proud of them as responsible citizens. And 30% of the students who enter Willamette come from Oregon, 43% of our graduates remain in the state of Oregon and find meaningful work to become taxpayers within the state. And I would also remind you that like many of the students also from our other independent colleges, will graduate in 4 years, not 5 years or more, meaning they enter the workforce and become taxpaying citizens of Oregon sooner than they might at other places. But, of course, our experience is the same as our colleagues at other schools, and that is that these worthy and needy students are receiving fewer dollars in Oregon Opportunity Grants. The average grant for Willamette students in 06-07 was $3,994. In 07-08, it was $4,132. And in this current academic year, 08-09, it was $2,581. So thank you very much for looking at this issue, and I hope you will find the means to help these worthy and needy Oregon students. Thank you.
Thank you. And the tuition at Willamette for?
$33,750.
Thank you.
Chairman Haas, the rest of the council, I would like to, number one, thank you so very much for having an Oregon Opportunity Grant.
Why don't you start with you?
For the record, For the record, my name is Radu Bobernak, and I'll start off from the beginning. I'm not from the United States. I'm actually an immigrant here. I came from Romania, and I came to the U.S., and I came to Oregon. And in Oregon, I came with Solve when I was a fifth grader here at Willamette University and the Capitol, and I saw at Willamette University, I heard, non nobis nati sumus, which means not unto ourselves are we born. And I said, what a wonderful idea. And so it grew. Willamette grew on me. And I said, oh, well, I'll go to Willamette. And then finally it came, I had the papers all written out, and my parents, they told me, well, how much is it going to cost? And I said, $45,000. And right then, but then I told them, don't pay for it. I'll find a way. There's always a way to pay for it, because this is the land of opportunity. And I did find a way to pay for it. I got a federal loan. I got one of the Willamette Perkins loans. I got just about any loan that I could think of, as well as Willamette scholarship, $15,000. And still, that unfortunately, that could not pay for all of it. And for me, it was stressful because I told my parents not to pay for this, but it's difficult, you know, you take that pressure upon yourself. And then I went and I talked to Ms. Hoban, and I wish I would have talked to Ms. Reiner, but unfortunately I couldn't. And I said, do you know any opportunities? Do you know any way that I could finally cover this? And she told me the Oregon Opportunity Grant. And I said, really, something like this exists here? And I was just so excited because I knew that I could see the light. I could find one of the opportunities, a way to maneuver, if you will, so that I could finally pay for my tuition, a tuition that I could never pay myself. I mean, I would have to go out to a bank and get a loan, and with the economic downturn, as you know, it's getting more and more difficult to do that. So I just wanted to thank you, because this does make a difference. It really does make a difference, and I really appreciate that. Thank you.
Thank you. Marco.
Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. My name is Marco Fiallo, and I am a 28-year-old non-traditional student at Willamette University. I was in the United States Marine Corps for 4 years and 3 months, did a tour in Iraq and Afghanistan, came back, and here I am now going to school full-time. I'm a sophomore, will be graduating 2012, hopefully, going through the 3-2 business program over at Willamette. Just wanted to thank you for the opportunity to talk, and thank you for allowing or giving me some money to be able to make this commitment to go to the school again. I was working, got out of the Marine Corps, and was kind of like lost in space, didn't know what to do. Ended up working as a government contractor, did merchandising for a while. The government contracting was a good job, paid well, but just no future. To get out of there and coming up here and applying to Willamette was something that really helped me. Their financial aid package, the Equal Opportunity Grant, and everything is something that took me to consider coming here. I looked at the same thing, looked at the price tag, and I was like, $40,000. Well, how's that going to happen? And it just, you know, you submit your financial aid package. I'm on my own. I work 40 hours a week at the Salem Veterans Center, and I still make ends meet, and I'm here now asking, you know, for things to go better for us and to continue on helping us, please, advance in our education. And now, like, we're in a financial crisis. I think I understand that we need the money, but if we have to invest in anybody, it should be in education. Shouldn't be. We need to invest in education for our future, for tomorrow, to come up and be able to become better residents and to be able to just give back afterwards to our community. Thanks.
Thank you very much, and thank you for your service to our country.
Senator Cruz, Willamette Grant.
Something that's been bugging me and nobody's been able to answer, what is that thing you're building next to GATCHI?
that would be our math department, as well as computer science. It's going to be fantastic next
cool.
year.
And I appreciate the fact that you're maintaining the architectural integrity of the university. So.
Thank you.
We wanted it to be an attractive view for you.
Thank you for coming over.
Thank you.
We have Paul Missall.
You do. Thank you. Thank you, Chairman Haas, committee members. My name is Paul Missall, for the record. I'm a professor emeritus at the Pacific Northwest College of Art. And I just wanted to tell you how important the arts are to our region and to our community. I'm speaking in support of the bill, 478, and I'm speaking in support of any means you can to facilitate our students are pursuing their education at our small college in Portland. You know, I can't tell you as an educator, I've been teaching there since 72 and still continue to teach on a part-time basis. Seeing students that you bring along for several years come up to you and say they can't continue their studies because they're having some difficulty with their financial arrangements. So I'm just so appreciative of any of the efforts you can make to facilitate the financial condition of these students. I think the arts are important. Again, I appreciate anything you can do in your efforts on the behalf of those students. Thank you.
I thank you very much, and I work in my other job with one of your graduates, who's an outstanding designer. So
thank you very much
for your testimony. Thank you. If that is all the testimony we have, I am going to close the hearing on Senate Bill 448. 478, excuse me, and I'm going to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 444. Senate President Peter Courtney is here, and Mr. President, if you would like to come up with your aide, Sasha Pollack.
You know, it's kind of be embarrassing to be the president of the Senate.
Boy, you come up and everybody leaves, you know?
Am I to begin to introduce me? Did you introduce me? Do I start now? No, Chair.
Mr. President,
the administrator is supposed to tell you what the bill is.
Hold on here. We do have an amendment in our packet. Yes. You got that? I want to make sure.
We're still trying to get over the fact that how quick you can clear out a room, Mr. President. So.
And Dana, if you want to give us the uptake on the amendment.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, the -1 amendment before you replaces the measure but for the applicability provisions. It prohibits student organizations or their members from intentionally hazing potential members. It defines what hazing is, and then it broadens the student organizations that it would apply to include fraternities, sororities, athletic teams, or other organizations operating on a college, university, elementary, or secondary school campus.
Mr. President.
Thank you, Chair Hass, Vice Chair Morris, Senator Metzger, Senator Cruz, and Senator Bonamici. Lady Administrator Richardson. My name is Peter Courtney. I live at 2925 Island View Drive North here in Salem. I'm a state senator in District 11, which includes major portions of Portland and also Jervis and Woodbury. I introduced this piece of legislation, Senate Bill 444, when I came to my attention that the Oregon University system had, through regulations, administrative rules, specifically in Section 8 policy for collegiate athletics, subsection, 8X, rules which prohibited athletic teams from engaging in activities. But when you look at the existing Oregon revised statute, specifically ORS 163.197, hazing, and you look at subsection 3, the state law on hazing does not apply to curricular activities or athletic teams or of or within the college or university. And it really stunned me that you'd have administrative rules that would say we do not want coaches and members of athletic teams to haze members of athletic teams, but our statute said the law does not apply to that. I could go into, and you have my written statement, I'm not going to read it to you. I was somewhat of a coach in my life, involved in athletic activities. I also involved in the athletic activities at Western Oregon University, where I've been an employee for a long while. And when it comes to hazing, I think we all agree that that is not something we want to tolerate, not only in college athletics, but also at the K-12 level, which this bill also gets to and reached out to. I'm not even sure, and I can get myself in trouble. I don't mean to be a show-off, make noise like a lawyer. I don't even know how the administrative rules of the Oregon University systems can exist, because if you take administrative law classes in law school or you're a student of that, there's an old saying that an administrative rule which is properly and formally promulgated has the force and effect of a law. But every administrative rule has to come from a statute, just like every statute has to come from a constitution. And if your statutes don't come from a constitution, basically they can't exist. And if you have administrative rules that aren't based on some law, it can't exist. So I don't understand how this rule's ever existed, or to the extent that it does, it cannot be proper without changing the law. There was an incident in Western Oregon. I'm not going to make a big deal of it. involving hazing, involving a certain athletic team there. And it was the kind of thing that shouldn't have happened, and it did. And that's how I fell into this, and because we decided how we were going to handle it on the campus, this particular incident, in terms of the players, the student athletes, and the coaches. And next thing I know, I did this research, and I found this out. And so I've asked to introduce this bill, and I understand it's not controversial. I don't know of opposition. I worked with the Oregon University system. They were a little bit nervous when I started to get involved. But so I just ask you to review this, Chair, and members of the Education and General Government Committee, and to the extent that I'm right, you might think about passing the law, if nothing else, to make sure that our statutes speak to hazing in athletic teams in the state of Oregon involving students. That's all I'm trying to do. It's not sensational. I believe it's correct. I'd say the council's helped me draft it. We worked on it starting before the session with the university system, and I believe my interpretation of the law is right, Chair and members of the committee, that there is an inconsistency, at least in terms of the law and the administrative rules or the Oregon University system. Thank you, Chair, and members of the committee, letting me testify on this.
Thank you, Mr. President. The amendment replaces the bill, and it looks like athletic teams have been dropped and replaced with student organizations.
Correct.
And so if I'm in a student organization,
athletic team is a student organization.
A fraternity or maybe even more loosely defined, like a chess club or something, and a member of that organization does something under that maybe the majority of the, you know, aren't involved, then how would that work? Is it fair then to, is this organization in violation of committing a Class A violation?
Yes, because if you go to page 2 of the amendments and you go to subsection C, the definition of student organization means a fraternity, sorority, or athletic. In other words, it's a very, Chair, as I'm answering your question, the definition is very comprehensive. So that organization, yes, would be in violation of state law. And even though we've removed the athletic team, we've included it in student organization, as we did sorority, fraternity, or other organization, is that organize or operate on a college, university, or elementary school. In other words, you have a club or a group that's together, an organization which has been sanctioned by that academic school organization, and they're doing this, they're in violation of state law.
Okay.
That's right.
I guess my friendly question, if you will, is what if you have two rogue members of an organization that perform some kind of hazing act that is not sanctioned, condoned, and is condemned by that organization? Is the organization then still at fault?
Well, let me just start by saying, if you look at line 11 and 12, a member of a student organization who personally violates subsection 1 of this section commits a Class B violation. So at least we'll go to those two individuals to help answer your question. But you've asked another question, and I don't have the answer to that question. I do not know if the organization is, because you can have rogue members. For example, in the situation at Weston, it wasn't rogue. It was all the seniors were messing around away with all the underclassmen, and including the captain and even et cetera, so it wasn't rogue. But you could have a single member of an athletic team, a very powerful member of the athletic team, that with the other one decided they're just going to go out and go, you know, visit some freshmen one time and do some things to them. Well, they'd be in trouble, according to what I just said, if the statute passes. But what would you say about the athletic team? And I think, I'll tell you what I think. I think it depends. Let me give an example. This is what happened. If the coach in the athletic department of the school has not given orientation sessions to the students, and you understand what I'm saying, your athletic, which they're supposed to do, informing them we will not permit hazing, I think then they're going to get themselves in some trouble, if you understand. You understand, because that's a violation, because there's usually those kinds of policies that exist. You're supposed to train, give these sensitivity sessions at the beginning of every season. The coaches are supposed to do it. The athletic director is supposed to talk to coaches, and the coaches are supposed to talk to assistant coaches, and the assistant coaches are supposed to talk to their students, their student-athletes. In the case of sorority, you have the president of the sorority, et cetera, et cetera. You know what I'm saying? The president of the organization every year should be doing this. If they've done all that and you've got some rogue members, then I think probably it's an individual thing and probably the organization would be all right in a question of fact and law, if I may say so, in a court of law, Chair Hess. Am I working to help answer your question, which you're torturing me with here? You understand what I'm trying to say here?
Yes, sir, I am. I'm not trying to torture you, though.
Do you think I tried to answer your question, Chair Hess?
I think you tried. I just, you know, it just pops out as a...
What?
As a...
What's existing?
As a hanging issue.
I have a question.
Senator Bonamici?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Courtney, I know that you've assigned me to serve on the Judiciary Committee, but I can't remember off the top of my mind, what's the difference between a Class A violation and a Class B violation? Because apparently the organization that violates commits a Class A violation, but the individual member commits a Class B violation.
Yeah, we do hold the organization to a higher standard, clearly, for that. But I don't, the distinction, obviously one's more severe than the other. I can't tell you exactly what this, okay. Chair has said about it, I can't give you the exact differences in terms of the severity. But you do point out something. We're holding the organization to a higher standard than the individual. That's all I can tell you. You'll have to
I'll
ask
look it up.
Legislative Council. I'm sorry.
Okay. Senator Cruz?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. President. If you were not a student member of an organization and you committed one of these acts described in the bill, it wouldn't be a crime. So why is just membership of an organization the creation of a crime?
You want to say so?
In other words, if you're just a student, you're not a member of an organization, and you do one of these things listed in the Act, you're not subject to the penalty you are if you are a member of an organization. Okay. So I guess my point is I'm not sure that all these sort of activities take place within any structure in the university. They could take place in a dorm. So I'm trying to figure out why we have a separation here.
While the President is looking at that, and maybe Senator Bonamici can answer this one. I'm just curious, first of all, for my benefit, what is a violation? Senator Cruz indicates it's criminal. Is that a violation? It's criminal?
Yeah.
Okay, all right.
Yeah.
Fine. I'll look it up.
Okay.
Okay. Chair Hass, Senator Cruz, for the record, my name is Sasha Pollack. I work in Senator Courtney's office. In response to your question, Senator Cruz, the list of violations of hazing, most, if not all of those things, are illegal, and the person or organization that are involved in those things could be subject to other statutes, including, you know, harassment and... you know, they include whipping, beating, striking, branding, all of those things obviously are illegal. I think the reasoning behind the hazing statute, which is already in existence and which we updated for in Senate Bill 444, is the a lot of the things that young people are subjected to are things that they're required to do to initiate them into an organization or a group that that they are forced into, forced servitude, extreme amounts of eating or drinking things or eating things that are not food, things that, in other words, they could these are the person that is compelling them to do the thing is not actually committing the act. They are telling them to do something that is endangering them.
Chair Hess, I think you questioned through me because I didn't come into this with the individual mind. I was gravely concerned that an athletic team with athletic members, that was a structure, had activities that go on that were totally improper. That starts there. I wanted to speak to the organization more than I wanted to speak to the individual because the organization, if you will, was the empowering group. It's the hype and the notoriety you get being a student athlete through the organization. And also it was the organization that created this family where you get this kind of activity going on. So that is what I'm speaking to. For sure, there are rules and other policies on every campus that speak to individuals, bullying, because you're getting close to bullying now, and active like harassing people, whether it's a professor in a classroom or students, et cetera, et cetera. And so that is where I've been, what we're addressing in these things. So you should not assume that an individual can do this kind of activity on an individual basis and necessarily get away with it. And if there are other rules or statutes to apply to it, there are. That's not what this is all about. This is about organizations that are sanctioned by a high school or grade school or a college or university, student organization types. That's what it's about. You want to speak to them. Because it has been the tradition and it has been the culture of many of those organizations to do these things in the past as a way of initiation or et cetera, et cetera. And we as a society have decided over it, watching it evolve, we will not tolerate it because it led to death. It led to injury, and it led to humiliation. And so we have now turned to our administrative rules and our criminal laws, as well as civil laws, to say what used to be we will now not tolerate. And so, but you have to do it on a team basis and an organizational basis to get the message across. So that's the best I can do with your question.
Senator Morse.
Thank you. I'm wondering, do we have the definition of student organization defined in statute?
In statute.
It's on page 2.
Well, we do. It's in statute in the sense that this amendment speaks to it in a comprehensive way. Chair Hass, Senator Morris, on lines 11 to 16, page 2. Do you see that?
I apologize.
Well, you shouldn't apologize because that's new wording, because if you look at what it's replacing, lines 16 to 22, I think we've made an attempt to redo the definition in a very comprehensive way. So, yes, student organization is meant to include exactly what I said in terms of organizations that are officially sanctioned by a college, university, elementary, or secondary school. For purposes of providing members opportunity to participate in student activities. So we're not just talking, by the way, about athletics here. You do understand that, even though athletics was what got me into this Senate Bill 444, we're talking about student activities. You could have a debate team. You could have theater. Oh, yeah. I mean, I don't mean to get crazy here. You could have a theater group. There are many groups on your campus and schools that involve not just athletics. I mean, the yearbook. I know you say, well, that could never happen in the yearbook. I don't know. I'm serious. And so those are all student activities sanctioned by a given student academic school organization.
Okay.
Senator Cruz? If I could, I just, you know, understand what you're getting after here. I was a member of a fraternity, of course, this back in the Stone Ages, and we went through a thing called initiation. And I think we probably violated some of these going through the process. The end result of our initiation was it drew us closer together as a group, which was the design of it. It's somewhat similar to when you go through boot camp, somewhat similar. I'm also looking at the daily doubles we did in football that may skirt the edge of this as well. And so, I understand your intent. I'm just wondering... I just have some caution, Mr. President. Exposure to the elements. What does that mean? Does that mean if we're out practicing daily doubles in 110 degrees, that's exposure to elements? I don't know.
Well, okay. Chair Hass, Senator Cruz. I was in daily doubles in the hills of West By God, Virginia.
It's probably hot there, too.
And I was brutalized as a football player. And I was a very tough football player in the hills of West Virginia, where they play the coal mining regions. And I always swore that if I was ever a coach, I would never do to the players what was done to me. I also was subject to hazing in the high school. My sophomore and freshman year, when I became a junior, my junior class decided on our own we would not tolerate the activities that were done to those individuals. The coaches were not involved, and we stopped it. And I'm not going to describe, because there's women here, some of the things that were done to us. And it didn't bring us together, and it didn't make me any tougher a football player. In fact, it probably made me a nastier human being in ways that I'm not proud of in terms of one of my activities off the field. Because I was in a bad mood, I was ill-tempered because I was humiliated. And some of the things they did were very painful. Very painful. I don't mean football painful. I mean painful. And very degrading. Very, very degrading. And we decided we weren't going to tolerate. This was a Catholic high school. The juniors stopped it, and the seniors were didn't dare mess around with this because some of us were as good as the seniors and meaner and nastier. So we stopped it. I was at Quantico until they told me I had bad feet training to be a Marine Corps officer. And when I was at Quantico in 1967, certain activities were going on because of heat and because of physical exhaustion. And we have seen even there a remodeling of how you train men and women to be soldiers, because we have learned that you can still be a very tough football player, you can be a very motivated athlete, and not be have treated in the way that we used to. We've evolved as a society. And so, yes, I do believe today, I was in football, I was never allowed any drink of water. I was running the ground until I dry heaved, until I collapsed, and I was told that's the way to be tough. Today, you don't give water to football players in heat, you're going to be in serious trouble. And that's true at Oregon State and University of Oregon and Western Oregon. Western Oregon will not practice anymore in football if the temperatures reach a certain height, or they will not put them out in uniforms. They will change their practice schedule because we know what heat can do to people. And we will definitely give people water breaks, water breaks, etc. We just treat them. And I believe the football players today are every bit as tough as when I played. So we have evolved as a society. And in no way am I understand, and this does not interfere with a coach being able to train athletes. They understand it. You got to run. You got to do calisthenics. It's tough. There's nothing here that fits the definition of hazing or harassing. Now, I'm not trying to do that, and I wouldn't try to do that, because you got to be in shape to play sports. And you know that, Senator Cruz. I'm sure you're a great athlete. And you still have to go through that. So there's no attempt here to do that. But there is a statement here is we're not going to humiliate student-athletes. And I'll tell you something. You're asking for trouble. Today, student-athletes will not tolerate what they tolerate, Senator Cruz, when you were playing our opponent. They won't tolerate it. They will not tolerate it. And I think as a society, we shouldn't tolerate it. And fraternities. I got a son in a fraternity at ASU. And he told me something that happened, and they're at campus, they're in trouble in some of those fraternities down there, because it's fun up to a point, and then it's dangerous. In the middle of the night, left out in the middle of nowhere, with no clothes on, with other things being done to you, it reaches the point that it doesn't bring people together. It's humiliating, and it's downright dangerous. And so, I mean, you know all that, Senator Cruz. You don't have to hear me from that, and I know you would never condone that. But we've had to pass rules. Unfortunately, there have been some incredible tragedies, lawsuits. A major person who was a president of one of our universities, who became a president of a major university in the Northeast, had to resign her presidency because of the hockey team's activities, and the hockey team of that school, which is a national championship hockey team, had to cancel their entire season because of elephant walk drill that were made to be done by the other group of players on that hockey team. Lost the presidency over it. And that's hockey. Canceled the entire season, the remainder of the season, and eventually this president, because he didn't move quickly enough, they lost the presidency over. Well-known person, this figure, who became the president, back a very good school, a wonderful school, in the same conference that I was in when I went to the University of Rhode Island. So I know what you're saying. I'm not trying to baby athletes here, but I do think as a society we have had to make some strong statements about how young people are treated when they're in organizations by people that they're, you know, because they pretty much subject themselves to these organizations. They want to join them. They want acceptance. It's a very powerful thing when you're young. They want to do well. And you know, and plus, these people, many of them, they're role models. Athletes are role models, and they're sending signals. So, you know, I don't mean to be melodramatic. I'm very pleased with your question. I've done the best I can to answer that question.
Thank you, Senator Metzger.
Just briefly, first of all, Mr. President, I appreciate the bill on what you're bringing forward, and I think it looks really good, especially as I was looking at it again, just to kind of reiterate what you mentioned. This is actually existing law, and I see all those violations are all part of the existing law, but what you, I think, have done is to tighten this up in some of the definitions. And getting to some of the things Senator Cruz asked about in terms of, you know, being out in the woods, et cetera, and all of those are tied to if it subjects an individual to an unreasonable risk of harm, unreasonable or adversely, the safety. And I think that's actually tighter than what we passed before. I think it makes that more clear. And so I'm glad you dropped out calisthenics. But no, I think it's good. I think it improves the existing law, and that it makes it a little bit more clear what we're trying to accomplish here.
Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wondered if anybody wanted to know what the violation of Class A is $720 and Class B is $360. Unless this was changed in 2008, which I don't think it was.
Senator Courtney, I hope you don't think we were hazing you here at this committee. I know this. I thank you for bringing this issue. Many years ago, when I was a newsman, I covered a fatality at the University of Oregon as a result of a fraternity hazing. So I know this is a very serious subject. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Members.
We close the hearing, public hearing on Senate Bill 444, and Senator Morissette is here, and I'd like to open up a public hearing on Senate Bill 538.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, we've got the bill before us, 538, as well as the Dash 1 amendment. And I think Senator Morissette would like to focus on the Dash 1 amendments. Is that? I think that's what I'll tell you about in any event. The Dash 1s replace the measure, but for the emergency clause. They require the Department of Education, to the extent that funds and personnel are available, to implement programs linking physical activity and academic achievement, just as the bill does require a report to the legislature on any programs funded, any funding applied for, and information that goes out to school districts on direct funding opportunities. We do have fiscal revenue statements on the Dash 1 amendments.
Senator Morissette, thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Bill Morissette, Senate District 6, here to talk about a new approach. In fact, I'm sorry that the President didn't stay around for our testimony, because every session he has had a bill on physical education, and I had a bill on physical education several sessions, and only to see them go away because of unfunded mandates. This is not a physical education bill. This is a bill that relates to physical activity and learning. It's kind of interesting because it's been in the news lately. There are several books out. This is the latest book by Dr. John Ratty, Spark. It came out a few months ago, and there's quite a bit of information to show that there are definite benefits. We're about wellness, and last session we did pass a bill dealing with healthy foods, getting them out of school, or getting junk foods out of schools and replacing them with healthy foods, and that is a step forward for wellness. It would be nice if we could do something about the activity part of it. This bill does deal with physical activity, but it's more of an individualized approach. And so what I would like to do is turn it over to Ann Summers, who is a consultant who, I don't want to use that word loosely. She is a friend. She's someone who I've worked with for the last couple of months on the concepts, and she is a consultant on wellness. And I would like her to talk a little bit about what she's doing with organizations that she's working with and what some of the results are. So with that, I will let you introduce yourself, Ann.
Thank you, and thank you, Chairman Haas, for having me here. Thank you, Senator Morissette. My name's Ann Summers, and I am a corporate health and wellness consultant, also a workplace health and wellness consultant, which means something quite different than it has in the past. We are at a very important juncture in our society right now, where we are in crisis with our healthcare system, we are in crisis with our health, we're in crisis with our healthcare financing, and we have to do something. So that's what I do. I work with, right now I'm working with a trio of tribes, to teach them and implement a culture of wellness on site, help them become acquainted with what is available now that has not always been available in the past. I also work at a corporate site, again introducing a culture of wellness at the work site. What we have done in the past is obviously not working. When we wait until we get sick, we're utterly passive. We go to a doctor, we get a prescription, and then we repeat however many times we need to in our lives until we completely break down. The concept of wellness, and I'm sure that all of you are familiar with that, the concept of wellness includes the whole life of the individual, including their health and their psychological well-being, their environment, physical and as well as spiritual and mental, intellectual, all of that. And it includes the individual, their family and their workplace, and also the entire community. The only way that we can really make progress with wellness is to teach it in an integrated way. And so what I do is I go work at corporations and at these tribes to help them integrate the financial approach to health and wellness as well as the physical approach to of wellness for the entire individual and their families. So it's quite interesting working with the tribes and working with working at the corporate level, because interestingly the tribes, the tribal members, and I'm working with a casino at a tribe, so it's a little bit different than the tribe itself, but the culture is the dominant culture definitely is the tribe. The tribes know that they are in very, very serious condition health-wise. Interestingly, they're very open to being healthy. They are eagerly absorbing what they need to do, what they need to learn. And the contrast is at corporate sites where people are a little bit more educated, they also tend to be a whole lot more resistant. Kind of think, you know, the danger of having a little bit of knowledge. So my purpose, my function is to introduce a culture of wellness and get it up and working at work sites. So I'm very excited to be working with Senator Morissette to be able to expand into education, into the lives of our children, because that is our future. That is not only their future, it is our future as a human race and as members of community. So I have, I can easily say, 35 years personal experience with wellness. I've been very, very attentive to that since I was a teenager, succeeded along those lines, and so I think it's time for me to weigh in. I am writing a book. It's called Toward a Culture of Wellness, How America Can Gain More Health, Energy, and Smarts Than Ever Before. And what I'm here to do today is talk about the new science of exercise and the brain. Like Senator Morissette pointed out, this is one of several books written by an internationally renowned neuroscientist and psychiatrist, and it is a meta-study that shows the literally thousands of studies that have been conducted in the last 10-15 years showing an intimate connection between our ability to think, between cognition, and the movement of our bodies. All right, we are finding now that we literally cannot perform at our peak level or anywhere near it. We cannot even perform fully functionally unless we are moving around and exercising. It's not the body or the mind. We have to have both to do well.
Let me just interrupt for a minute. This is a pilot project that we're asking the Department of Ed to be involved in, and they're very happy to be involved. What we're asking is that they apply for some grants, which I think are readily available, and we would like to do some pilot projects. Schools would apply for it. We would set up their criteria. And it would be absolutely essential to keep track of the results. Now, the studies that we're going to talk about, they have tracked the results, and they have proven to be very successful. And so there is that direct relationship between physical activity and the biochemical synapse of the brain will actually grow. Mm-hmm. This is the kind of like a miracle grow for the brain. And it does translate into better scores and better academic achievement and better lifetime skills. So that's kind of what we're all about, and I'll give it to you.
Okay. I would like to introduce you the very, very simple version of how it is that exercise and cognition work together. There have literally been thousands of studies, as I mentioned, and here's a summary of the science behind exercise in the brain. The basic chemistry of the brain is really quite simple. 80% of the interactions in the brain occur based on just two neurotransmitters. One of them is called glutamate, and I'm going to focus on that primarily. The other one, and that one stimulates activity in the brain. It allows us to learn. And then there's GABA. I won't go into that at this point. Others, primarily studies before the last 10 years or so, focus on serotonin and norepinephrine and dopamine. All right, you've probably already, all of you have heard of that. Those are the feel-good drugs, and we used to think that that they were the most important. But in fact, well, here's how this works. When the brain is stimulated with a new piece of information, activity occurs between neurons, and there's actually a physical process that happens. And when we come to understand something, it's because this physical process has taken place. So the neurotransmitters carry out the signaling, but what we have found recently is that the most important process is not the neurotransmitters, it's not the signaling. It's based on the most prominent factor in the creation of the infrastructure in the brain that allows for learning, and this is called, there's a factor that is basically the boss of this process, and it's called BDNF, brain-derived neurotrophic factor. Now, here's what happens. The initial request information is presented to a human being, and then the neurotransmitter glutamate jumps across the synapse to prepare the other side for information. All right? The initial delivery of this glutamate then kind of gets a train going. It gets the information processing, and so the other side is prepared for more information. And then the more information gets sent across this same synaptic connection, then the stronger the connection becomes. So where BDNF comes in is that it unleashes a chemical process when BDNF is called in. It unleashes a chemical process that increases the voltage on the other side of the synapse. Okay, and that improves the signal strength, and when the signal strength is improved, then the alertness of the brain also increases. So BDNF then summons serotonin and other neurotransmitters. So, you know, I could go into more detail. You've got this written in front of you, but what I want to point out here is that BDNF comes from one thing. Even though pharmaceutical companies are spending tons of money to try to figure out how to put this into a pill, we don't know how to do that. We don't get it from our food. We get it from one activity, and that's exercise. And it's not just any exercise either. It is individually appropriate cardiovascular exercise. This the very first observation of the connection between cognition and movement was made in 1995. This is new science. But since that time, 5,500 studies have been conducted on BDNF alone. We have a pretty solid understanding of how it works. So let's get back to our students. It was a PE teacher, of all people, who identified first, he didn't have the science, this came after him, but he identified first that exercise seems to prime children's brains for learning. And so he demonstrated this to other teachers and to the superintendent of his school and ask them to send all of the students to their most difficult class right after usually about 45 minutes or an hour or so of really vigorous cardiovascular exercise. And we're not talking sports, we're talking fitness. And so...
Ms. Summers,
yes.
This is fascinating. I just should tell you, we've had this debate on a different... different component of physical education on the difference between sports and fitness.
Yes.
We put it dodgeball versus wind sprints. And in fact, had Summit High School and testifying on the experiments they're doing in with regard to fitness and training.
I'm really happy to hear that.
Yeah, and we're trying to change. In fact, a bill that we're going to hear today was going to try to nudge the definition of physical education to include conditioning as opposed to kind of the old style.
Outstanding. I'm really happy to hear that.
This is a fascinating issue, and you're right, it is new science. And
yes. So when this physical education teacher had some experience behind him, he put his school district in a TIMS study, which is the Trends in International Math and Science study, along with almost 250,000 other students around the world. And despite Naperville's very modest budget, the eighth graders that took that TIMS test came in sixth in the world in mathematics, ahead of all Western countries, all but a few countries to the east of us, to the west of us. And that was an outstanding performance, but they then fared first in the entire world in science. Okay, that astonished everyone. Now, no one is really ready to say that the only thing that was different was the exercise, but they haven't identified anything else that is different.
Well, I'll tell you what, I don't think you've got a lot of detractors on this. Before we get too far, though, I do want to hear from the Department of Education. They wanted to weigh in on this. And perhaps. Okay. Morgan Allen.
Let's step back.
And Tanya Fresno.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, Morgan Allen with the Department of Education, and we'll keep it brief so you can have more time to hear from your presenters if you'd like. But we appreciate the opportunity to work with Senator Morissette on this bill. We basically took a lot of things that we are sort of doing on an ad hoc basis or that have been suggested to us by others, and I think we've been able to formalize them in this bill. And the most important thing is that we've been able to get to a place where it does not have a fiscal, so it doesn't need to go to Ways and Means, and I think we can do this within existing resources. So we'd be happy to answer any questions about the components of the bill, but we don't have too much to say about it. I think it's a good piece of legislation, and we really appreciate the opportunity to work with Senator Morissette to make it workable for us in these difficult budget times.
Okay. You weigh in on that, or you agree?
I agree.
I like that. That's good. Okay, well, boy, you guys were easy.
I have a question.
Senator Bonamici.
Thank you. I'm looking at the Dash 1 amendments, and the way I read this is that you'll seek public and private funding for programs yourself for the department, and you'll also provide information to districts on funding opportunities that are available directly to the districts. So what happens if you get funding under 1A, how do you allocate that to districts?
Just, Mr. Chair, Senator Bonamici, just give me a minute to review that section.
It's line 6 and 7. I'm just curious about how the department will then allocate. If you sought the funding and you get the funding, then how do you allocate that?
That actually is a really good question. I'm not sure the answer to that question. I think it was the intention when we discussed it, and I can let Senator Morissette talk about this, but we really want to find, and I can get you the specific answer about how it would be specifically appropriate, but we're really looking at some pilot projects. So I'm assuming we'd have kind of an RFP process where we'd look at school districts that are looking at innovative ways of doing this, but I don't know if you guys have anything to add to that.
Well, getting back to what Ann Summers was talking about, there's a lot of data available on what has been done successfully and tested. We would want to have a program that had very rigorous measures, standards that had to be met and could be tested and verified. It would be a pilot project. There would be an RFP, and there would be some work done creating the program to make sure that it was a valid program that could be replicated and encouraged other than schools to do it. But this would be a pilot project that would perhaps, maybe there would be two of them. And people would, the information would be sent out and people would apply for it. And we would work together and along with Ms. Summers and others to establish one that we knew would do the job.
Mr. Chair and Senator Bonamici, the other thing, too, if you look at lines 11 through 16, generally a lot of these types of grant monies have stipulations that come with them that you're awarded this grant to do a certain thing, so we would obviously have, you know, most of them are not going to be open-ended, so there's very likely going to be some strings attached on how we distribute those funds and how we allocate those funds as well, and we're quite used to that with federal grants in particular. So.
And I see that in the reporting section, it includes programs funded as provided by Section 1, so that's part of the report, is to provide where the money went. I'm just trying to figure out if there's any, if you need rules or if you have existing sort of guidance on where, if you get money, where is it going to go, and how you make that determination.
Mr. Chair and Senator Bonamici, I believe I'll have to go back and double check, but I believe we already have an account established in another statute. I think it's referenced in the bill. I was just looking for it. I think it's on line 18 and 19. We have an education account established in 326.115 where we would deposit the monies. So,
one more follow-up, please.
Senator Bonamici.
I understand that. It's just once the money gets there, how do you decide which districts get the money, is my question.
Mr. Chair and Senator Bonamici, the bill does not tell us how to do that, so we would, I think, be left to either an informal RFP process at the agency, or perhaps we could look at making some rules through the State Board of Education.
Thank you.
Other questions?
Just one other quick thing. Ann Summers has been involved in this as a lifelong pursuit. She's been a consultant. She has access to people who do grants for these programs. The Department of Ed, though, has their expertise, and we would rely on the Department of Ed to do the rulemaking within the scope of the statute to establish a program, as I mentioned before, that was testable, that was had credibility, and to then allow school districts who were interested. In fact, Ann Summers and I met with our in District 19, and we had a number of people from the school district who were really, really excited about doing this. They're doing innovative stuff, and as you mentioned earlier, you have another bill that deals with some of the same things. So I think this is a new way of dealing with wellness and learning. It's a new frontier that we're getting into that is extremely exciting. So I think the Department of Ed will more than adequately come up with the rulemaking and in consultation with the experts, establish a program that will be tested and be successful.
Okay.
With no fiscal impact.
How
to the state. Heck of a deal.
Well, thank you, and especially to Ms. Summers for your expertise and helping and engaging Senator Morissette on this. Okay. Thank you all and to the department.
Do a quick work session, Mr. Chair.
I know that Senator Morris wanted to vote on this. I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 538. And open up a work session on Senate Bill 538. Senator Metzger?
Mr. Chair, I move the dash one amendment, I believe, to Senate Bill 538.
Senator Metzger moves the dash one amendment to Senate Bill 538. Any discussion? Seeing none, adopted.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 538 to the floor as amended with the due pass recommendation.
Senator Metzger moves Senate Bill 538 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Senator Bonamici.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think this is a good bill, and I plan to support it. I'm just a little concerned about the lack of structure. There's no rulemaking authority in the bill, and I don't know if the department has some other rulemaking authority somewhere, but you can't really make rules without statutory authority. But I'm willing to give this a vote, and I hope that there's the ability within the department to work with the senator. There is also the possibility that during the work on this, that the information will be provided to the districts, and the districts will apply directly for the grants. And I think that might smooth things out a little bit. But I'll leave it in the good hands of the department and hope it gets worked out without rules, because I don't see any authority for rules.
Senator Cruz.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, follow up on Senator Bonamici's comments, I would suggest those are probably some clarifications that would be helpful and would charge the senator to have a conversation with Representative Gelser, because this will go to her committee, and maybe those things could be kind of tightened up on the House side. So.
Okay. Further discussion, seeing none. Clerk, call the roll.
Aye.
Senator
Cruz?
Aye.
Senator Metzger?
Aye.
Mr. Morse?
Excuse.
Chair
Hatch? Aye. Measure passes, and it's okay. I'd like to ask Senator Morissette to carry this bill on the floor. Okay.
Just don't talk yourself out of it, okay?
I'll close the work session on that bill, Senate Bill 538. Colleagues, we are not going to deal with Senate Bill 643. We do not have the appropriate...
Yes, we do. Mr. Chair, I'm sorry to contradict you.
I'm sorry. I thought you said that's why you weren't.
Sorry, on 444, we did not have the proper documentation, but we're all set on this if the committee would like to pass it along.
This is the one that just goes over to Ways and Means. Oh, I'm so sorry.
Then let's do it.
Have we adopted the amendment?
We have not.
Let me open up a quick work session on Senate Bill 643.
Mr. Chair, I move we adopt the Dash 1 amendment to Senate Bill 643.
Senator Metzger moves to adopt the Dash 1 amendments. Is there any discussion?
Mr. Chair, would you like me to indicate just quickly what's in there?
Sure.
That this is where we added the conditioning language. This is the physical education bill.
Questions? Discussion? Seeing none, the amendment is adopted.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 643 as amended to the floor with the due pass recommendation that the bill be re-referred to the Joint Committee on Ways and Means by prior reference.
Senator Metzger moves Senate Bill 643 as amended to the floor with the due pass recommendation and that it be referred to the Joint Committee on Ways and Means by prior reference. Any discussion? Seeing none. Any objection? Seeing none. So ordered. And that will close us for the day with one announcement that we're meeting in a joint session on April 1st with the House at 1 p.m. We'll go 1 till about 3 for purposes of online education informational hearing.
And Mr. Chair, just a point is that my Business and Transportation Committee does meet at that same time, but we'll endeavor to try and get our work completed as soon as possible so that I can rejoin.
Appreciate that. Okay.
Should be fine.
Other announcements? We are adjourned.
Otherwise, I'll join virtually.